right, I think we're going to be done.
Okay, I'm not the staff person, Bill, but I'll get them.
All right, good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and open up the Committee on Judiciary. I want to apologize, the chairs of the two committees, House and Senate, we have a meeting on Thursday mornings, and it ran a little bit longer than we anticipated, and so that's why we're getting a little bit later start than we normally would. With that, we have a few bills that we have for a public hearing, possible work sessions. And, Council, do we need to take any particular order?
Chair members of the committee, I can't think of any, but I do know that 3194 and 3295 have the most witnesses, three signed up.
All right, so we'll start at the top. I do want to make a, I guess just for the record, since Senator Bonamici's not here, she is excused and has been excused, and welcome back to Senator Wissett that had other obligations for the first part of this week. With that, we're opening up the first public hearing on House Bill 3194. Council?
Chair members of the committee, House Bill 3194 comes to you from Representative Barton and Senator Schrader. It includes prior juvenile adjudication for driving under the influence as a predicate for felony driving under the influence.
All right, thank you. And we have, I believe, three individuals who would like to give testimony. Jim, come on up, and Ellen Crawford, Allison Butterfield, I believe. And let me just ask you, I've opened up the hearing for 3194, and I know that you're going to be here for 3295. I think we'll leave it like it is. Just we'll do one bill, and then we'll see if anyone else wants to give testimony. If not, then we'll go right into the second one.
All right. Thank you very much. For the record, Jim Austin with Clackamas County's Community and Legislative Affairs Department. I'm here to ask for your support of House Bill 3194, actually 3194 and 3295. Both deal with juvenile matters in Clackamas County, and we've asked for both these bills because they relate to and will help us out with the unique way in which we handle juvenile DUII and juvenile diversion programs in the county. We've asked for 3194, and Ellen Crawford, our director of the juvenile department, and Allison Butterfield will talk a little bit more about this. But in short, because we process juvenile DUIIs through our juvenile court, and juveniles technically receive dispositions as opposed to convictions, there's been some conflicts with the third strike enhanced sentencing. So we have a fix for that, and I'll let Ellen take it over from there.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Pogzanski and members of the committee. I'm Ellen Crawford. I'm the director of the Clackamas County Juvenile Department. I'm pleased to be testifying before you this morning regarding House Bill 3194. In 2005, the Clackamas County Juvenile Department initiated youth under the age of 18 who were cited for DUII to come to the juvenile court. We have been working with the circuit court judge in the juvenile court and with the district attorney's office when we initiated this program and worked through a collaboration to develop policy and procedures to handle the youth under the age of 18 in juvenile court. We felt specifically there were several compelling reasons that we could handle those youth and hold them more accountable in the juvenile court facility rather than in the adult circuit court. Allison will give more specifics in terms of our outcomes and justification in terms of why that I believe that was a right decision at the time. Through the implementation of our DUII program, we have encountered several barriers, significant barriers. The first one that we're addressing in House Bill 3194, it proposes language change to ORS 813.010 subsection 5 and 813.012, which is Oregon's enhanced Dewey sentencing statute. This allows for a third DUII to be charged as a felony. The current language only references convictions, thereby allowing the legal argument when a youth is adjudicated and disposed of, they are not considered convictions. So if a third DUII as an adult, where they have been adjudicated twice before in juvenile court, they would have the ability to start over as a first conviction rather than it being their third and counting towards the enhanced felony filing. So the proposed change is language change to add that convictions also include adjudications and dispositions so that when juveniles are adjudicated in juvenile court for first, second, third time Dewey charge, that we can uphold the intent of the Dewey statute and file the third Dewey charge as a felony, whether that be in juvenile or in adult court. We currently have a collaborative agreement with the district attorney's office that we will automatically transfer a youth to their adult system for a third Dewey, so that we're trying to prevent a youth from being able to have more than two, giving us the ability to for that intervention. I would like to ask Allison Butterfield to give you a couple of very specific examples where this has been a significant barrier in terms of our ability to hold the youth accountable under this specific language that exists.
Thank you. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Allison Butterfield with the Clackamas Juvenile Department. Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. I am the probation officer at the Clackamas County Juvenile Department, and my caseload is the DUIs, and we've had them since 2005. And I have submitted, or I believe Mr. Austin has submitted paperwork indicating some program data. We have had 80 total referrals. 45 cases have been closed successfully. 27 cases are still under supervision. 4 cases were not successful and resulted in commitment to a correctional facility. 9 youth that were ordered into the DUI diversion program have been revoked, were placed on probation, and the majority of them were closed successfully. The one that I think is most applicable to this House bill is that we've had 4 kids since they entered the program that have gotten their second DUI while they were under our court supervision, and both of them, or all 4 of them, were adjudicated. And during the course of one of the dispositions, the attorney made the argument that they are, in fact, not convictions, so they're only dispositions, and then that they cannot be held against them in adult court. So that is certainly a concern. We haven't had anybody yet that has received their third one, although that would be sent to the adult court. But those 4, given the current language, basically if they get their third one, they will be able to start over again in adult court as their first one. So that is one of the concerns that we have, and it does make it a little bit more difficult for me as a probation officer. I can address House Bill 3295 whenever you're ready. Thank you.
All right. Let me ask for if there's any questions. I've got some stuff I want to put on the record. All right. So I'm going to kind of give you some perspective. I serve as a prosecutor in Lane County at the municipal court level. We have an automatic remand that was signed decades ago, and so unless the juvenile department takes the child in, they have 10 days to put them or have them come back into the juvenile system. They go to the adult courts, age 15 and up. And I'm curious as to what your, numbers show as to the recidivism. I read through the stuff about the 5%, because I have not seen in my practice, too many youth coming back through this process. And I'm curious to just see how this has worked for y'all and what type of results and what type of program you actually run. And this is going to be offline from the hearing, because when we put them through, they go through just as if they were an adult. If they are eligible for the diversion, they basically do a diversion as just any adult would do. And at least in the municipal courts I'm working with now, I've not seen that type of repetitiveness of people coming back. And it seems like the numbers that you've given us today, you have at least 4 youth that have been back within thinking that, I assume you take jurisdiction of them for these type of offenses at 15, or are we talking younger?
15, yeah.
Okay. So 15, 16, and 17. So you're talking basically a 3-year period before they would be in the adult system anyway. Mm-hmm. The other part, I guess, is that in reviewing this, and this is more for the record, when you look at the sentencing guidelines, the guidelines does set up for juvenile offenses, both person crimes and non-person crimes, and that's, I guess, part of my comfort for making certain that since we've already got a procedure and process to count juvenile dispositions in sentencing guidelines, that it does make sense that we would include dispositions that involve DUI as we would other type of offenses. So other questions? Did you have any comments?
Yes, Chair Przanski. When I've been at the juvenile department for 21 years and helped to initiate our juvenile drug court program. And so I learned a significant amount in treating adolescents who have substance abuse problems. What I have found is that adolescents need intense supervision and accountability. They're very different than adults. Developmentally, their brains are not developed. They need a different treatment approach. And I felt that putting them into an adult Dewey Diversion Program with adults was not meeting their treatment needs. And at least in our county, the offenders who were in the adult Dewey conviction programs were case banked as far as management, so they didn't receive intensive supervision or accountability. I got several calls from circuit court judges regarding their frustration with 15 through 17-year-olds, their inability to hold them accountable because they weren't allowed to sentence them and put them in jail.
Right.
And so we were trying to attempt to overcome those barriers when we asked to bring those youth back to the juvenile court. And I believe our outcomes are very positive. The 5% recidivism is in relationship to other Dewey charges. We haven't yet been able to pull the data on overall criminal charges of youth who go through the Dewey Diversion Program. But I feel that we're by far meeting their needs better in the juvenile court.
All right. Bill?
Chairman, members of the committee, this bill doesn't really apply to juveniles. It applies to adults. Is that correct? Because you're talking about a third conviction.
The current statute that talks about the enhanced charging is under the traffic code, which is 813.050. That is the only language that reflects Dewey diversion programs and how to charge Dewey referrals, so that when the youth are handled in the juvenile court system, they are not included as a conviction in order to count towards the enhanced charging of a felony. What we're trying to do is model the current intent of the Dewey diversion statutes. We feel that because we are handling a youth in the juvenile department, they need to have that same level of accountability that was intended for any 15 and above person driving who is charged with a Dewey to have the same level of enhanced charging. And so we don't want them, because they're in juvenile court, to get one freebie of a Dewey and a second or a third. We feel that the intent should be that they is held at the same standard as in the language of 813 in the traffic code.
Your follow-up question. But when you're talking about a juvenile, you're talking about an adjudication.
Yes.
And when you're talking about an adult, you're talking about a conviction. So if you're talking about including the adjudication as a conviction for the purposes of 813, then in most cases, and probably all cases, you're talking about that counting when the person's an adult, not when they're a juvenile. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, may I? Committee Counsel Taylor. Yeah, I mean, it could be. The intent of the statute is enhanced on the third. So this could apply to a juvenile who is a problem child and who receives three DUIIs while they're a juvenile. This would make them that enhanced sentencing charge applicable to them. Or it could be that they've received one while they're a juvenile, another while they're an adult, and another. But we just wanted to capture those dispositions that were handed down in a juvenile court setting and make sure that there's no legal argument that those didn't count towards that third, if they're, whether or not they're an adult or a youth at the time. We just want to make sure that those are tied together, and that's all we're attempting to do with the statute, just have the disposition, make it clear that these dispositions still count towards that enhanced. So they may or may not be an adult after that.
Yeah, so counsel, what my understanding is that if you have a youth that, say, at age 15 gets a Dewey, and then at age 16 gets a second Dewey, and at age 17 gets a third Dewey, they could, in fact, if they chose to, but they don't do this, they could keep them in the juvenile system, and that they would be charged in that system as a felony Dewey within the juvenile process.
My understanding.
But my understanding is that what Clackamas does have is an agreement with the DA's office that if you had a youth that met that criteria, they would actually refer them for adult court for handling it in
the adult system. But you're also correct that whatever happens in the juvenile years of that person is going to stay with them as it pertains to that 10-year window of seeing whether or not a person is going to go. That's what I'm coming away with.
No, I apologize. On the Chair Pozanski, on the House side, we actually had our DA who handles these juvenile matters, and he was unable to be here today. So
I think we're there.
Okay,
I think Council is just putting some stuff on the record.
Okay,
making sure we got it covered. So let me ask you a couple of things. Since you're taking that position on Dewey's, if a child age 16 is involved in reckless driving, are those going into the adult system, or are they staying within the juvenile system?
Chair Pozanski, they're staying within the juvenile system.
Okay. All right. Just different ways of different counties. All right. Any other questions or comments? Thank you all very much. You all just stay where you're at. Let me just see if there's anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 3194. Not seeing anyone, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 3194. And I'm ready to open up a work session, and we'll open up a work session on House Bill 3194.
Mr. Chair, move HB 3194 to the floor with due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 3194 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. The Chair will carry this one. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 3194. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3295.
Chairman, as the committee, House Bill 3295 comes to you from Representative Barton and Devlin, requires that diversion programs for persons under 18 years of age must include a prohibition on the use of intoxicants during the program.
Members of the committee, again, for the record, Jim Austin, Clackamas County Community Legislative Affairs Department. In a similar vein to 3194, we've asked for 3295, due in part to the unique way in which Clackamas County handles juvenile matters regarding DUII, and this one pertaining to juvenile diversion program. In short, the reason we've asked for this is because there are specific statutes in the diversion statutes pertaining to adults that there's a specific language for a DUI diversion program agreement that stipulates that the person must not use alcohol in conjunction with operation of a motor vehicle. In the applicable juvenile codes that allows for diversion programs, there's actually no specific authority for us to require a diversion agreement, which has caused some problems, which is why we've asked for this bill. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Helen Crawford.
Chair Pozanski and members of the committee, thank you. Excuse me. The juvenile department DUII program is modeled after the ORS 4813.200, which Mr. Austin said requires individuals who enter into Dewey diversion to sign a diversion agreement and not to use intoxicants with while operating a vehicle. Again, there is a significant barrier in our ability to hold youth accountable for two reasons. In the juvenile code, there is no reference that allows us to have a youth sign a diversion agreement, and there is no reference or provision for the use of intoxicants as a compliance condition to participate in diversion. Consequently, we've had youth in diversion programs who have used substances. We've brought that back before the court, and there's been legal argument that there's not legally a violation of their participation in diversion. Again, Ms. Butterfield has some significant examples of that in terms of her case management. This really jeopardizes our ability to require diversion agreements. It jeopardizes the use of noncompliance as a disqualifying factor. The language that we're proposing is in reference to the juvenile statute 419C.255. We believe this language is critical for us to not compromise, again, the existing Dewey statutes and it also compromises the integrity of our Dewey diversion program and our ability to hold youth accountable who continues to use substances while participating in the Dewey treatment program. I'd like Allison Butterfield to give you some specific examples of what she's encountered in trying to manage this caseload.
Thank you. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, I'm the probation officer that deals specifically with these youth, and while the youth are in the DUI diversion program,
I need you to go ahead and put your name on the record.
Sorry, Allison Butterfield, Clackamas Juvenile Department. While the youth are in the DUI diversion program, they are also simultaneously on what's called conditions of release with our court, and I case manage those cases, unlike in adult court where they have to complete a treatment program, but there is no probation officer to whom they report. And one of the requirements is that while they're in treatment, they not use substances, but then once they complete the treatment program, there is no requirement that they not use substances. So I've had a number of cases come up where the youth has been compliant while they were in treatment, and as soon as they completed the treatment program, they began using. One specific example I had is a youth that had 9 dirty UAs for marijuana over the course of 2 months. As soon as he completed his treatment program, I took him back to court, and his attorney argued that there was no language in the diversion paperwork that would preclude him from losing his diversion, and he got to stay in the diversion program all the while he was using the entire year that he was in the program. I've had another youth who got another MIP, and that other MIP did not preclude him from being able to get be revoked from the diversion program. I've had so many examples of that. I've had to try to be very creative with the youth because if they do violate by using, at this point, there's not a whole lot of legal argument that I have taking them to court and trying to revoke their diversion, so I do have to try to be creative by giving them community service and other sanctions. But as of this moment, using after they get out of treatment doesn't allow me to try to revoke their diversion.
All right, questions? Allison, I do have a question for you.
Yes.
If these are diversions that are being offered in lieu of adjudication.
Yes.
For the youth.
Yes.
I'm having a difficult time understanding why you can't have a contract that they enter into that basically says you shall not do these things. I can understand on the Dewey part where how the language is structured, it may not get us there. But when you are doing your own county juvenile discretionary diversions, it seems like you could have that language in there. Can you give us a little information about that?
Well, Chair Przanski, members of the committee, we do actually have that language in their conditions of release with the court that requires them to not use substances. And so when they do violate that, I can bring them back to court and put them in detention based on violation of conditions of release. But when we talk about the next step, because they are in the DUI diversion program, there is no further ability for me to impose any other types of sanctions because the reason that they're on conditions of release is based on the DUI diversion program. And so in the diversion program, this specific paperwork doesn't allow me to pursue that. I can certainly take them to detention based on the contract that they sign, but to what end? There is no other ability for me to impose any other types of sanctions because it's based on the diversion paperwork.
So let me just follow up because one of the examples you gave was an MIP.
Yes.
And so was MIP also in a DUI diversion?
Yes, Chair Przanski, yes. The youth was in the DUI diversion program. He had received another MIP. We were able to proceed on the MIP, but he was able to continue keeping his diversion.
Okay.
So he was fine, but he got to stay in diversion.
Counsel.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Commander, I read the statute, and it also talks about formal accountability agreement, and it fits into that particular statutory framework. And if I remember, a formal accountability agreement is a contract between the juvenile department, which the juvenile department can offer the juvenile in lieu of going to court. There are certain crimes, usually sex crimes and Measure 11 offenses, are excluded. If it's in the nature of a contract, you can't put that in the accountability agreement?
Chair Przanski and Committee Member Taylor, we actually don't offer formal accountability agreements for youth who have DUIs as part of the agreement that we've made with the District Attorney's Office. All DUIs will go through the court system, and again, it is part of their conditions of release not to use, but it does not have any application to the direct language in the diversion paperwork, which is the argument that the attorneys have used. Yes, you can put them in detention, But no, you can't take their diversion away because the language on the diversion paperwork doesn't say anything about it. We can certainly make the contract with the youth, but if they don't fulfill that contract, I have no ability to proceed to revoke it. So we don't do formal accountability agreements as per an agreement with the district attorney's office. We have that contract with them so that at least I can put them in detention, but I can't do anything beyond that.
Can either of you tell us why there's not that formal accountability contract? What's the purpose of not having that DA's wanting to not require?
Chair Pazinski, DUII, we consider a community safety risk. It is a high-risk offense that threatens community safety of all of those who are on the streets. A formal accountability agreement does not allow us to hold youth accountable when there are violations. You cannot use detention as a sanction when a youth is on a formal accountability agreement. You can only have informal sanctions. We don't feel there's the level of accountability that we need to have for youth who have been charged with a DUII.
Okay. You want to follow up?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my recollection of formal accountability agreements, and I've been looking at them lately and was involved when we drafted them, the juvenile department, except for certain offenses, on the first-time offender has the right, without the district attorney's approval, to enter a formal accountability agreement. On subsequent offenses, they can only do so with the assent of the district attorney's office.
All right. Any other questions or comments?
It's beyond me.
All right. So I guess what counsel's suggesting is that maybe you might want to have another discussion with the district attorney's office as to the procedures that are currently being used, because it seems like the department has a little bit more flexibility under the law to do some of this. That, I mean, it may be just a policy decision that the county's making, and I guess so be it. You know, regarding what you're here for on the bill, I personally have no problem moving it forward to take care of that. But at the same time, it seems to me that for whatever reason, where state law provides certain procedures to be allowed to be used, it's not being utilized to what's permitted under the statutes. So.
And my, Chair Brzezinski, my recollection, when we entered into this collaboration with the circuit court judge and the district attorney, I don't have a reference, unfortunately, but I thought and whether it was our policy agreement or a legal argument that because of the current Dewey statutes in the adult court, these Dewey charges had to be adjudicated in order for youth to enter into a diversion program and follow the statutes as set forth in the adult court.
That's probably true, because you think about, I mean, on an adult side, you have to enter a plea of guilty or no contest, and then if you get bumped from the program, you don't go to trial. So that might be the issue there. I understand what you're saying now. Okay. All right, any other, I know this has been stimulating for everyone else on the video. Any other questions?
We're going with your judgment here, because I was lost a long time ago, so.
All right. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 3295? Not seeing anyone coming forward. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3295, open a work session on 3295.
Mr. Chair, move HB 3295 to the floor as long as I don't have to carry it.
All right. Senator Boquist moves House Bill 3295 to the floor with a due pass recommendation so long as he doesn't have to carry it. Is there any discussion?
Ditto.
Any objection? So ordered. And the chair will carry this unless someone wants to volunteer.
I think Senator Bonamici, as a lawyer, can know all about it.
All right. Well, Senator Bonamici will be assigned this one, 3295, and I'll be back up if necessary.
I got the conceptual idea, but I got lost in the details.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
And let's see. So if I didn't, I'll close the work session on 3295. And we have one other person that signed up on the other three bills, so I'm going to go ahead and open up that one now. That's House Bill 2394.
members of the committee, House Bill 2394 comes to you from Representative Cullen. It allows service a subpoena on a witness under the age of 14 by delivering a copy to the witness or the witness's parents or guardian on item. Clarifies the delivery of subpoena in a civil or criminal matter must be served upon the agency employing a peace officer 10 days prior to the date the officer's attendance is required. Clarifies that services made to officer need not be delivered 10 days prior to the required attendance.
All right. This committee technical bill.
Okay, we have Tammy Wood here for Linn County Sheriff's Office.
Chair Pergansky and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tammy Wood. I'm a captain with the Linn County Sheriff's Office. I'm also president of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association Civil Command Council, so I'm here not only representing my sheriff, but sheriffs across the state and urging your support for this bill. House Bill 2394 makes basically three changes to the statutes. First, it allows us to serve a subpoena to the parent or a guardian of a witness under 14 years of age. Juveniles under 14 are reliant on their parent or guardian to get them to court. As the statute is currently written, we must serve the juvenile personally. The younger the witness is, the more likely they are to not understand the subpoena, and they may also be frightened. We did have a sheriff's office recently who was directed to serve the juveniles at their daycare and was insistent that they be served there as opposed to at home with their parents present. Originally, the District Attorney's Association did speak to us, and they were somewhat concerned about being able to bring contempt charges against someone who didn't show up. However, they felt that if the statute does direct us to serve the parent or the guardian, and the parent or guardian does not bring the child to court, that they could pursue an order to show cause for contempt. So they're fine with this language now. The second change just cleans up some language regarding service of subpoenas to law enforcement officers. As it's written, it's confusing as to whether we can serve a subpoena personally to an officer 10 days prior, or if we can just personally serve them within a few days prior. The new language makes it clear that the 10-day rule applies only to the individual designated by the agency to accept subpoenas. And then the third change makes a change to the stalking order statutes. The statute itself is labeled service of order and entry of order into law enforcement data system. However, the statute is silent as to how to serve the person. This would clarify that by directing the order be served by personal service, and also it's having us serve a copy, which would then allow us to fax a copy between the sheriffs, as we can now do under all the other protective orders.
All right, thank you. Questions? Okay, Senator Bookquist first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just trying to clarify so I understand what we're doing in the three parts. In the first part, we're talking about delivering the subpoena to the parents of 14 and under only, because I could obviously see, I guess I could see situations where there's a 16-year-old that's afoot, and that's the problem to start with. And then could you expand? I mean, you said the District Attorney Association were opposed to it, and then somebody was supposed to deliver a subpoena to the daycare. Trying to grasp the rationale here. I think I understand the basic intent, but I think I just, can you expand a little bit about it? And the second question I have is, can you expand, 10-day rule applies to service to an individual designated by an agency. Does that mean there's only one person in a sheriff's or police office that can accept that? You've got to educate me. I'm not the lawyer here. So,
Chair Pergansky, Senator Boquist, as far as the subpoenas, currently the statute requires that we serve the witness personally. Mm-hmm. And what we have happening in practice is we're going out and serving all these children who are under 14 years of age personally. They don't understand what the subpoena is. Right. They're reliant on their parent to get them to court anyway. Mm-hmm. And so we want the ability to serve the parent or the guardian so that it's certain that the a little more certain that the child will make it to court. If we serve, for instance, the two children that were in daycare, they don't know what that subpoena means. They could toss it aside, never take it home, and then
they
never show up in court.
All right.
I've got that.
The language regarding the 10-day rule. The statute states that we are to serve an officer personally, and then there's an or, the individual designated by the agency not less than 10 days before when the appearance is sought. It's been confusing to a lot of police officers. Our civil folks are used to looking at statutory language and the meaning. And when we go to serve a police officer personally and it's 10 days prior, they say, we don't have to go because it says here in the statute, you had to serve me 10 days before. Our argument has been that the 10-day rule applies only to the individual who's been designated by the agency to receive a subpoena. And that is because that allows that person 10 days to get it to the officer so that he can appear in court. What the change does is separates that into two sentences. One is that the officer can be served personally. The second sentence is it can be served to the individual as long as it's 10 days prior to when attendance is sought. As to your question about whether there's only one individual, no, there's not. Usually supervisors are designated as the people to receive the subpoenas. And so in practice, we normally would go serve whoever the supervisor on the shift is. And it doesn't necessarily have to be the supervisor directly over that officer.
Okay, I think I understand.
All right. I've got a couple of things I wanted to follow up on, and we'll start with that. This, to me, is just basically clarification, because when you look on page 3, lines 3 through 7, that's what the current language is. And when you read it clearly, my reading of it is that the officer themselves can be served personally. Then you have the conjunction, I guess, of or. Then it goes into the employee that's been designated by the agency. So we're not changing this, and I know that it's the reason that they have a person designated is because officers are not easy to catch up with to actually personally serve. And so if you are going to do office service, you have to do it within prior to the 10 days, and there would be somebody. I know that at the departments that we have that I work with, if the person that may be the custodian supervisor for these type of records isn't there, then there's something, someone else. And a lot, like you said, a lot of times it's a supervising officer that would be in that position. I do want to go back to the first fix, though, and that is where you have a child who's under the age of 14, and under this new provision, you would be able to serve the parent or guardian. Now, what if, and there's two things, if the child who is under 14 is afoot, they're not residing, they're a runaway, what impact is that going to have? And then maybe tying that into the second part about who was the District Attorney's Association concerned about not being able to hold accountable through a contempt for non-appearance, the parent or the child?
Chair Przanski, originally they felt that if we served the parent that they wouldn't be able to hold the child accountable. But as we spoke, they agreed that children are reliant on their parent and that they would pursue the parent for the contempt. As far as runaways are concerned, I would imagine, I know in my office at least, if the parent said the child's a runaway, if we looked and indeed they're entered as a runaway, we would not serve the parent. We would return it to the DA with that note.
All right. Counsel.
Mr. Chairman, of the committee, ma'am, if I'm reading this, if the witness is under 14 of age, the subpoena may be served by delivering the copy of the witness or to the witness's parent. So you could still serve the 14-year-old, the 13-year-old.
Chair Przanski and counsel, that is correct. It's a permissive. We can serve the juvenile or we can serve the parent.
All right, Senator Volquist.
And I think the question is for one of the two lawyers here. My assumption is that with the May clause in there, that if a parent had a runaway, that they would be able to argue, or the presumable rebuttal, or whatever you guys call this thing, would be that, okay, they're a runaway, you know, they're not here, and you would have think that the district attorney or somebody wouldn't be able to hold them in contempt of court because their defense would be they're not living here, they're a runaway. Am I kind of right? Because I'm assuming in some of these cases, if you've got a 14-year-old that's coming to court, it's probably because there's a problem.
Yeah. I mean, I think that in practice, that's probably true, but under the law, I don't know if you couldn't still, I mean, they could actually go forward with a contempt. Then you're going to have the judge, and he or she's going to make that decision. Mm-hmm. It doesn't stop the proceeding. The end result after going through a formal hearing would probably result in not being in contempt, but it doesn't stop the action from going forward.
Sure, Przanski,
if I might. When we look at these, most of our subpoenas are directed towards adults. We do get juveniles in some cases, and I don't recall in my practice not being able to find the child because they were a runaway, if that helps you at all.
I'm sure my only comment is Linn County is a better county than Multnomah. You have more population, so a bigger area.
All right.
So, any other questions?
Yeah.
Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 2394? Not seeing anyone, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 2394. Open a work session on House Bill 2394.
Chair, move HB 2394 with your best.
All right, Senator Volquist moves House Bill 2394 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? I'm going to put on the record, this is one of those ones we'll just have to watch, because what I don't want to see is a situation where a child who is under age 14 and the parents who have absolutely no control over that child is somehow getting, let's say, pulled in the process where, you know, everyone knows that it shouldn't go that far. So we'll just watch to see how this goes. I'm assuming and expecting that those who are serving are, in fact, going to take these things in consideration, and I hope that they follow your practice of actually returning stuff back when it's been demonstrated that the child has made flight from the house and the parent, even though we'd want them to have control over that child, doesn't.
Chair Przanski, the Civil Command Council does hold training sessions twice a year. In April and in September, and we're able to educate the sheriff's offices across the state on practices, and we can bring that up as one of your concerns so that they understand that.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, on the record, I'd like to ditto what you just said. I mean, I had the same concerns, the same line of questioning.
Yeah. All right. All right. Thank you very much. Any other questions or discussion comments? If not, any objection to the motion? Not hearing any. So ordered. And volunteer? All right, Senator Volquist will take House Bill 2394 to the floor. All right, we have two other bills that are scheduled for today. I'm going to go ahead and open up the first one. Let's see, in order. Let's see. I think that's going to be House Bill 2664. And, Council, why don't you give us an overview on that one?
Committee, House Bill 2664 comes to you from Representative Wilson and Senator Przanski. Allows the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission to apply and receive gifts and grants and award grants, removes the provision concerning entering into contracts without the following Department of Administrative Services procedures, and allows the commission to adopt rules. I may have made a mistake on the staff measure summary, Mr. Chair. I think they removed the DAP provision.
It just says apply for grant.
All right.
It's
black,
yeah.
Okay.
My mistake.
All right. So we've got that taken care of, correct, mm-hmm. as to it does take that out. So the purpose of this is basically to allow our Criminal Justice Commission to have that authority to be able to, let's say, bring money in to mm-hmm. the into the process. Currently, the statutes do not provide for them to be able to receive grants. The gifts part, I'm not really sure why we have that. I guess that would be some type of, I guess, lack of better terms, someone who wanted to donate money to the commission as compared to a grant that you would go out and potentially apply for and to be able to administer.
Push grants, just push grants.
These could be federal grants,
right,
yeah, burn dollars.
Yeah, the gifts are, I think, push grants. I had a discussion with AG, had lunch with him, I don't know, two months ago, and the gift portion of this sort of thing is those federal programs where they push dollars down. You don't actually don't have to request them.
Okay. All right.
So I'm assuming that's where that came from.
Okay.
Discussion.
Senator Weston.
Yeah, Christian, I wonder, I don't see in this law anywhere where the CJC is required to follow up on the grants that they make as far as for performance and accountability and outcomes, and I wonder if that is covered in some other statute.
Council.
Chairman of the committee, there is nothing specific in here, but I do know as a matter of policy that they do. For example, they administer drug courts, mm-hmm. and they do a very thorough job of checking up on results and checking up with the quality of the drug courts where they give that they give funds to, mm-hmm. and I do know it's part of their charge to do research. So I just think as a matter of policy, they're not here, but I would assume that if they gave a grant, they'd check up to make sure that the grant money was being used for the purposes that it was intended, and they would check up to see what kind of results, assuming the grant was large enough.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor. I'm pretty sure the CJC does that. I think that our other agencies have a tendency not to do that. We put a lot of money out there and don't follow up. I wanted you to put that on the record. Thank you.
Yeah. So, Senator Wissett. Yeah, no, I'm just going to follow up on this first. Senator Wissett, so, I mean, are you comfortable with the explanation, or did you want
yes.
to correct? Okay, good. Senator Dingfelder. Senator Boquist?
Just to follow up to the discussion that when I had lunch with the Attorney General, even if they get a grant or a gift, they still have to come back for, they still have to have a legal authority for legislature. This just allows them to go get it.
Mm-hmm.
And then once they have it, then they have to still have to get spending authority.
Mm-hmm. From, well, it's like any other agency.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So
I had a bill very similar to this.
I'm going
to
go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2664 and open a work session on 2664. Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2664A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Any objection? So order. And Chair will do this one since my name's on it. And then I'll close that work session, open up our last public hearing that's going to be on House Bill 2299.
Chairman of the Committee, House Bill 2299 comes from the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association, allows the county to adopt standards for releasing juvenile offenders when the county's juvenile detention facility's capacity is exceeded, allows the county's juvenile department director to release juvenile offenders in order to reduce the facility's population to capacity, establishes a procedure for release of juvenile offenders sent pursuant to contract by another county, one county to another county juvenile facility or regional county facility to the number of agreed to in the contract, provides the county is not civilly or criminally liable for good faith release of juvenile offenders. Chair, members of the committee, that provision was
taken out.
It was modified.
No, they're modifying, yeah.
Modified.
It was basically modified by saying this does not create.
Right, and I'm going to go into that.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so is there anyone here who want to give testimony on House Bill 2299A? If not, I'm going to close the public hearing. I'm going to go ahead and open a work session on House Bill 2299A for discussion. And, Council, I want to just put some stuff on the record. Remember when the bill first came to us, it basically gave across-the-board immunity for liability. And if you remember, everyone, we had the Oregon Tort Claims Act stuff that came before us. We had an opinion that came from Dave Hendricks saying that you couldn't really have these type of clauses in the statutes. And so that's why that was removed. And what we have remaining is on page 2, that section or subsection 7, lines 19 through 20. And so I wanted to have a little discussion, Council, regarding what the intent of this is and whether this would be in any way in conflict with the advice of LC. I expect it doesn't, but I just want to put on the record.
Chair, it does not. This does not absolve them from liability, which simply does say that the statute does not create liability. What you have in Oregon, several cases, where the Oregon courts have said that if the legislature creates a statutory duty, and if there is a breach of that duty, there is third-party liability. And let me give the clearest example. A woman was picked up in Astoria for being under the influence, and as you know, that the police have an obligation to hold someone until they're sober. The woman was released, walked out at the police station in the traffic, got hit by a car and killed. The department was sued. The allegation the woman was not sober when she left, and that they breached their duty. The court found that the Astoria was liable to the family because it was a statutory duty. What this language does is, okay, there's a provision here that allows the juvenile department to release offenders, okay? So they exercise that duty because they have, if they're in capacity, they have an obligation to do so. This clarifies, but this language, this section does not create a cause of action and may not be asserted as a basis for a per se negligence claim. So if there's a duty created here and there's an allegation of abuse of duty, this language says, no, there's no cause of action.
Mr. Boquist.
Okay, let's use the same example then. They release the 14-year-old. Does the parent have to pick him up, or if they release him and they walk out the front door and get hit by the car? I mean, we have the same scenario all over again.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that other statute did not have that language because at the time it was not known that it was a new area of law. Okay. Not all states follow that line of reasoning, but Oregon and several others do.
So under this clause, line 7, if they release the 14-year-old to their own custody out the front door and they get run over in the crosswalk,
this section does not create a cause of action that may not be asserted as a basis for a per se negligence claim.
So in English, that means they can't automatically sue. They don't automatically have a right. They could always sue and say there was X, Y, and Z, but this doesn't say that there's necessarily a relationship between them. Is that what we're trying to say here?
Members of the committee, if you were representing the county, what you would say is that there is, because this language, there is no duty created here.
Okay.
On behalf of the youth, the juvenile department, therefore there was no breach of the duty. This section does not create a cause of action.
But would there not be still be a duty because it's a juvenile to get them to their parent, or?
Mr. Chairman, as a committee, I assume it could be that the juvenile walks out and takes a gun and shoots someone.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, my understanding of what they're concerned with is with the potential of needing to release individuals out, that just because they make the decision as to this person being released, that in itself doesn't cause a cause of action to evolve. I do believe that there are scenarios and circumstances that if you start adding facts to the situation of the 14-year-old, say the 14-year-old who's under the influence, and then something happens, there could be liability based on that.
MIP type.
Right.
Did you have any?
I have a different question.
Okay.
As I read this bill, currently the county court or the county commission can institute the examination of the juvenile facility.
Correct.
And this writes out to the county commission and leaves the county court in. And the question is, has the Associated Oregon Counties weighed in on this? Do they have any objection to it?
Chairman of the committee, I think it shifts it more from the county court. And the county court is not really, in some counties, the smaller counties, the county commissioners act as the county court.
Right.
So that's when it refers to county court. It's not referring to the circuit court.
Right.
So,
okay,
what you really have is a shift
of,
towards the juvenile director. Who
referring
is
to the form of government in the county. Okay.
Right.
I got that.
All right. Any other questions, concerns? All right, the chair will take a motion if the committee is ready to go forward.
I move, Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2299A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And I'll carry it unless someone else wants it.
That was a loaded question.
Right. Well, you know, I'm sure I'm there to share. All right, and that takes care of House Bill 2299. We'll close the work session on that. And tomorrow is Friday. We are meeting tomorrow. There has been a revision on the earlier agenda calendar for that day. I believe we've added an additional 3 bills to try to make up for some of the increased flow that we're seeing coming from the House. So with that, we'll be adjourned until tomorrow at 8.
8 a.m. tomorrow?
Yes.